Rain punished the thick walls of Northampton and turned the cold stone slick. The thin streets of the busy little town should have been full. But on a grey Thursday morning in early November 1380, it was wet, chilly, and quiet. Inside a small chamber adjoining the Priory of St. Andrew, tucked away in the northwest corner of the town, the Archbishop of Canterbury gave a signal, and above the clattering of the downpour outside, a long and familiar reading began. The text was Magna Carta, literally the Great Charter of England's Liberties. As it filled the steaming room, the damp handful of lords, bishops, and gentlemen gathered together were reminded of the rights, duties, and responsibilities they held and exercised as England's elite court and general council. It was the first day of Parliament. Or rather, it was the second first day. Parliament had been due to begin on Monday, but bad weather had enforced a 3-day delay. Still, the numbers were thin. These occasions were, by tradition, sparsely attended, but even by recent standards, this was a poor turnout. In the heart of the country, Northampton should have been an easy destination for everyone whose presence was required at Parliament. But that autumn had seen dark black skies and unrelenting torrential storms, which had turned the roads into thick and dangerous furrows. Travel, always burdensome over long distances, became treacherous as rivers burst their banks and flooded England's well-trodden commercial thoroughfares. Churchmen, laymen, nobles and their servants were all braving the elements to attend the realm's fifth Parliament in just 4 years. The Crown's needs were so immediate and severe that even the 13-year-old King, Richard II, had struggled through the downpour to arrive a few miles away at the Manor of Moulton. He was to lodge there for several months, surrounded by his household, his tutors, and his boyhood companions, holding his court in unfamiliar surroundings, while his countrymen attempted, on his behalf, to solve an impending national crisis. The threat that faced the crown and realm was clear and urgent. Peace with France, shaky throughout most of the century, had long since collapsed, and the French, seeing a power vacuum at the head of English government, knew they had the upper hand. England's enemies scorned the notion that the young king's government might be capable of reaching a fair and balanced settlement to the Hundred Years' War. French and Spanish fleets terrorized the Channel. The Scots were raiding the northern borders. Ireland was turbulent. English garrisons on the continent were impoverished, and the nation had been on a defensive footing as it anticipated invasion from both land and sea for the last 3.5 years. The south coast and the whole of southern England was in a state of heightened peril, and even Oxford, a couple of hundred miles inland, was planning for the worst and nervously considering making improvements to its crumbling fortifications. It was a measure of the severity of the crisis that Parliament had been called at all. January's tax, granted in a similarly thunderous Westminster, had been hard, and the Commons protested fiercely against what they saw as aristocratic financial incompetence. The deal they had brokered then was that the King could take his money, but had then to hold off for at least 18 months before coming cap in hand again. But the tax that had been granted there proved quite inadequate to the government's demands. And just months after Westminster had emptied of parliamentary attendees, an embarrassing repeat summons had been sent across the country to this new gathering in Northampton. Now the mood was one of marked reluctance to allow the cycle of waste and squander to continue.